Hello everyone, it's November 24th, 2015, and we have a great interview for you, during which Ben had to use his backup microphone as a result of technical difficulties. What's the moral of the story? Well, if you want my biased open source opinion, it's never trust a MacBook. Liftoff. And we've cleared the tower. Welcome to episode number 34 of the Orbital Mechanics Podcast. I'm David.
I'm Ben. How you doing, David?
I'm all right. How are you doing? I hear a cold.
Yeah, I've got a cold today.
you sound slightly nasally.
Yeah, this is like a super light cold, okay. So it's not like a big deal, but yeah.
You know, like if you get the flu, then by all means, just, you know, well, you can cancel it because knock on wood, I haven't gotten a cold yet. I haven't had one for, I guess, just over a year. I haven't had one since last winter.
Is the flu shot still effective this late in the season?
Well, yeah, it's still effective. What do you mean? Is it still effective?
Well, the later in the season you get it, the less effective it is.
Why would that be?
Because your body has less of a time to build up immunity.
Oh, I didn't know it took that long to build up the immunity. I thought once you
I don't know how long it takes, but it does take a little bit. And so like if you get it after, you know, it's already peaked in the population, then it gets less and less effective.
I know that there are issues that have to do with exactly what strain, you know, you have mm-hmm. the vaccine for, and it might not be effective at all. So there's always that problem. But I remember hearing, who knows, on some podcast, probably the Skeptics Guide, that they're working on a new technique to actually synthesize, you know, these vaccines in a much shorter period of time. Because right now you have to, what do they do, incubate eggs or something?
Yeah, you incubate them in eggs, yeah.
It takes months or something like that. But
we're always looking for the next thing that where we can find a universal vaccine or whatever. But, mm-hmm. you know, we just make small little incremental advances. But yeah, I didn't get my flu shot this year. I gotta go get it.
I have not either. I'm irresponsible. Well,
well, if you don't come in contact with children or strangers, like it's you're the least helpful person. But I talk to so many people on a weekly basis that, you know, and I'm like shaking hands with strangers, so I gotta go get it.
Yep, you need hand sanitizer. That's the key. Maybe not.
I've got some in the back of my van.
So let's move on to this week in spaceflight history. What was last week's clue?
What was it? What did we decide? Coke bottles in space?
Coke bottles in space.
Yep, and nobody got it. I thought for sure somebody was going to get it. So that reference is, you know, we call really thick glasses Coke bottles. In the UK, they call them jam jars, which I think is better because of the... what's jam jar? The alliteration.
Yeah, it's alliterative.
But anyway, back in December 1993, the 2nd of December, it was the launch of STS-61, which was the first shuttle mission to go service the Hubble Space Telescope.
This was a big deal back then. They had, you know, launched the Hubble Space Telescope and they got their first images down, and when you know it, they were just complete crap. They were very blurry. That would have rendered the Hubble Telescope just, I guess, useless. Yeah. So they had to do something about it. And I think it's an amazing feat of, you know, engineering that they polished this lens. It works, I suppose, a lot like it as a corrective lens would work if you got one from the optometrist. I've been told optometrist isn't a real word and it's supposed to be ophthalmologist. I don't know if that's true though.
Sure.
Whatever. Yeah. So they polished up a new lens and then they delivered it and installed it. Yeah. And it actually worked, which, I mean, this is a huge precision piece of hardware, you know, at least the lenses. It's kind of amazing that people are capable of this because it's like one of the smoother surfaces that have ever been manufactured by human beings, I think.
And then we put it into space.
Yeah. And then you load it on a rocket, take it up into space, take it out from wherever you're holding it, and then you install it with a couple of astronauts. Yeah.
Yeah, so STS-61 also installed the second generation solar arrays. Didn't Hubble eventually get a third generation as well?
I don't know. If they did, it would have had to have been during STS-125, I think, right? Wasn't that the only
one? Yeah, I think it's 125, yeah. Yeah, and I don't think they did. Anyway, they updated the solar arrays to those scroll solar arrays that are so popular. That's kind of how we depict it. Is with the second generation solar arrays. They also added 4 extra gyros. The very next month after the servicing mission, they got their first clear images. This was January 13th of 1994 was when we started getting those first real images. So very successful mission.
And on the most recent servicing mission, STS-125, when they had to... The point of that mission was to replace gyros, was it not? Wasn't that the main thing? I don't remember all of what they did.
They replaced... See, I should know this better because I really love all of those all of those missions. Mm-hmm. But on 125, which I believe was the third or fourth, I mean, they did a lot of these guys. They replaced a computer card and a couple other things. So maybe we should do a 101 segment about Hubble and fixing Hubble. I think that'd be really cool.
That would be fun. There's plenty to talk about there. There's just,
maybe we could get like Mike Massimino to come on.
He would be the guy to have. He's been there. He's done, he's had firsthand experience. The Hubble servicing mission, December 2nd, 1993. I'm surprised. Well, Ben, you're surprised. And I'm surprised too that no one got that. It seemed pretty obvious, except that when you had offered up the clue last week, the first thought that came to mind was advertising of Coca-Cola in space. I think on the Mir space station.
Yeah, but then what's your second thought though? I don't know.
I suppose, but I don't generally say Coke bottles to refer to big thick glasses. I always think of nerd goggles. That's
which you suggested saying.
Yeah, nerd goggles in space. I think had we said that, I think we probably would have gotten someone. But all right, so next week, what do we have for next week then?
So next week in 1936, since it's in the 30s, it's got to be a birth, right? So in 1936, this is the birth of somebody who was very important to the Apollo program. And I don't have a clever clue here, but I want to make it easy enough that people can actually get this one. Let's just say the Apollo computer. One of the computers on Apollo, somebody who is very, very important to that, was born next week, 1936.
That'll have to be good enough. Because we can't think of any clever clues. So yeah. No puns this week for that one.
So go ahead and send your submissions in on Twitter. That's #ThisWeekSF. Or you can email us at thisweek@theorbitalmechanics.com.
Right, so on to spaceflight news then. We got a couple of stories here. I'm going to tell you in advance, we don't have a SpaceX story, and I'm thinking now that maybe we should have, but we got a fairly long show coming up because we have an interview.
We talk
to
about
do.
SpaceX later on.
Yeah, well, we will, but not the thing that I think a lot of other people are talking about, perhaps. Never mind. We'll talk about it next week, perhaps.
What, the RTF date?
No, it was, well, now I don't even remember. Oh, no, that SpaceX was given a specific date as to when they are going to be flying crew on the Dragon 2.
Oh, yeah, they got that order. Yeah, I think that's straightforward enough that I don't really want to talk about
that's
it.
That's true. It is straightforward, and I thought that that was already more or less set in stone. I mean, maybe not officially, but weren't we all? I thought that we were all thinking, 2017.
It was pretty much set in stone, but they hadn't placed the official order.
Okay, yeah, so this just makes it official. That's, I guess, the only big SpaceX news, so I suppose we crowbarred
it. Yeah, but we're not going to talk about that, so.
We're not mentioning it. All right, so first story up, NASA partners with 22 U.S. companies to develop tipping point technology. So this article, I don't remember how I came across it. I think someone tweeted about this. It was quite fascinating. So this is what I like to see. I love it when a big government agency like NASA partners with the private sector to push things forward a little bit more than they otherwise would have been. So yeah, it's, I think it is called tipping point tech or tipping point technology. That's the term that is being used. So what is tipping point technology? The criteria, and I got this from the NASA article, I think just go to NASA.com. Well, we'll put the link in the show notes. NASA.gov actually, I should say. If you go to the NASA.gov article, you can read all about it. The criteria for a tipping point technology is an investment, and I'm just quoting here, an investment that would result in significant advancement of the technology's maturation, high likelihood of infusion into a commercial space application, and significant improvement in the ability to successfully bring the technology to market. So that's a bit of a mouthful, but you kind of get the idea. This is technology that's just about there, but needs a little bit of a push, and then maybe we can perhaps be using it and in some way applying it. There was a whole list of things that they had done, because as I said, it's 22 different companies. So 22 different companies, 22 different projects. I only picked two. I don't know if Ben, if you're looking at the list there, if there's anything that you wanted to mention, but I picked...
These are the two perfect ones to pick. So before we start talking about those real quick, I just want to say how excited I am just by reading this definition. Like, this is such a cool thing, and this is such a NASA thing to do. And I just love the idea of seeing, you know, these things that are really close to being super valuable, and we just want to push them over the edge.
Well, is that a NASA thing to do? Because I feel like they don't, I mean, they are proving me wrong, but I feel like they don't do it enough. It's, I mean, there are other government agencies, such as, you know, like the NIH, which I think partners with the university system much more. They just, you know, they're much more heavily invested. But when it comes to NASA, they tend to only contract with other, you know, corporations or whatever, and that's about it. It seems.
Yeah. Well, what NASA tends to do is they tend to see a technology they like and go and give people money to mature that technology, and then they roll that technology into a particular mission. So it's something they're already looking for. So yeah, what you're saying is correct, but I also feel like this is, you know, what NASA wants to do. I think if NASA had more money, this is what they would be doing more often. And it just, I don't know, it's super exciting and super satisfying. So you pick two here. One of them, the first one is actually from a company that has really fascinated me recently called Tethers Unlimited. Go check out their website if you haven't seen it yet. Tethers Unlimited feels very, I don't know, they feel like they're makers, kind of. I don't know what gives me that feel, but everything they do is about small satellites, and they want to produce really cheap components that do crazy things on orbit. It's kind of like somebody who builds hats for Arduinos. Yeah. Or is it shields for Arduinos?
Arduinos, I don't know. I know the... I don't remember. Yeah, I'm not sure. Hat is for the Raspberry Pi, if that's what you mean.
Oh, okay. It's like somebody who builds, shields for Arduinos. You know, it's just like, oh, here's a little thing that you can plug in your spaceship and check it out. All of a sudden, you have better communications, or you have better, you know, better propulsion, or like all these crazy things, and they're just sold in these tiny little packages. I'm sure you know more about this technology than I do. So why don't you go ahead and talk about this first one that you've chosen?
This specific project is called Hydros, and it's in all caps. So I don't know if that's an acronym. I don't think it is, though. But it's called Hydros. And what it is, this is so novel and neat, and I had never even thought of it. Like, I had never conceptualized it, because you're always trying to be innovative in space. And so it is essentially a thruster that uses water as its propellant, but not in any conventional way, because what it does is it also uses solar power to essentially break the water molecule and produce oxygen and hydrogen, and then you use those as your fuel. What occurred to me as far as why they wanted to make this possible is that you don't have to store super cryogenically frozen hydrogen or slush or whatever. I'm not sure what form it comes in. But yeah, with this technology, you can just store water, and that is so much easier than having to store liquid oxygen and liquid hydrogen, because because you have to keep them so cold, and there's always going to be a certain amount of boil off. But I don't think that would really happen at all with water, at least assuming that you can maintain a certain temperature.
Yeah, like you said, you can store water at a much higher temperature. And in fact, that's the one downside, is that you have to store it at a higher temperature, but that's not too hard to do. In space, you're usually worried about cooling yourself down. Water can be stored at a high temperature. Water is completely inert. Water is cheap and easy to get your hands on. And because it's inert, like, you can handle it with no worries. You could take this Hydros thruster and put it on a CubeSat and take it to the space station and have it ride in the pressurized section and have somebody handle it on orbit. I mean, you can't do that with anything else that has propulsion generally. I mean, there are a couple of exceptions, but for the most part, if you have any sort of propulsion module on your small sat, you can't put it inside the space station. This stuff is so inert. Like, you could have kindergartners build this, basically. I mean, obviously I'm exaggerating here, but it's like, it's water, you know, it's freaking water.
It's similar to, well, in fact, speaking of kindergartners, they do have those little toy rockets where you can use electrolysis and you can actually break water down. I don't know if you've ever used one of those.
Did they make those into rockets?
Well, I'm trying to think of where I saw it. I don't think I ever owned one, but my nephew, I think, had one, and it was basically you would add water to this little rocket vehicle, and then it broke, you know, the water molecule, and it would sort of fill the underside of the rocket up with hydrogen, and then at some point you hit a button and I guess it lights it up, and then it just, you know, flies off.
It's got like a spark plug or something.
Yeah, that kind of thing.
That's really cool. I would like to play with that.
Yeah, it's just and so this is that same technology, although, you know, quite a bit more sophisticated, but it's just such a novel idea. And as I was saying,
I don't even think it's that novel. I think that they have gotten really close to actually producing it.
It's novel to me because I had never thought of it, and perhaps I'm giving myself too much credit, but why didn't I think of this? Like, hey, you know what? Hydrogen's right. A problem, so why not store it as water and then use solar power? That's just such an obvious solution.
Well, I think the non-obvious part is, well, once you do the electrolysis, how the heck do you separate the oxygen and the water? Like,
that's a good question. I have no idea.
Yeah. No, I'm sure there's a really clever solution. Maybe we should try to get them on the show. But yeah, it's so cool. I think you really picked a good one when you picked that one.
That's one. Yeah. So there's, I don't know, I guess at least 22 different projects, maybe more. Yeah. So we're really just picking two here. So that's one. The next one, which we might actually at some point talk about in depth.
Yeah. This next one's really cool. So this is from Northrop Grumman, and it's called a reaction sphere. So we're all familiar with reaction wheels, right? These aren't control moment gyroscopes. These are reaction wheels where you spin them up to turn the spacecraft, and then you stop spinning them to stop spinning the spacecraft, as opposed to a CMG like what's on the space station where it's always spinning and you just push against it. Well, that's a reaction wheel. Is cool. And we always, like, one of the big things that is wrong with our telescopes in general is our telescopes usually lose reaction wheels. And so the idea is just, you know, make the thing mostly reaction wheels and then a little bit of science, because that way you'll be able to keep doing your science. Well, this is a really amazing alternative to a reaction wheel. It's called a reaction sphere. And so instead of just controlling one axis, a reaction sphere has a 3D motor that can spin this mass, this reaction mass, this sphere, in any direction, not just in X, Y, or Z. And so what's really amazing about that is that you save a lot of weight because you only have one reaction mass. You also save a lot of energy because if you can spin it diagonally, I'm guessing, I don't know about this one, but I'm guessing the reason that you save energy is because if you can spin it diagonally, you're just rotating it about one axis instead of adding two or potentially three axes to rotate it. But yeah, we're hoping to talk about this reaction sphere more in the future. And that's all we can say about it for now. But it's a really cool idea. And if you go look online, there are lots of really cool photos of Emery Stagmer, a friend of Tomorrow, on a Vomit Comet playing around with this thing on a parabolic flight, which it must have been really cool. So, yeah, go look for those photos.
I have one question, though, and maybe we should just save this for, you know, later on. But because these reaction spheres, you have a magnetically suspended sphere within the outer casing, right?
Yeah, I believe so.
So with that being the case, how effective, or you must need some pretty powerful magnets if you're going to be rotating a spacecraft around this, because you have to have reaction mass, but you have to impart force.
Well, think about a motor. Most electric motors don't make contact between, I forget the terminology for electric motors, but the magnets don't touch the spindle that they're enacting force on.
That's true. So I suppose I'm just underestimating the amount of force that the magnets can produce.
Well, and don't forget that you also don't need to apply a lot of force to this thing. You just need to spin it up really quick or get it spinning fast.
Plus, you probably have more time than I'm thinking, because in space, you just have to impart a little bit of force, and then, you know, you just kind of wait, and eventually it'll get to the correct orientation.
Yep.
Okay, so I guess that answers that. There are some things about reaction spheres that still confuse me. They seem kind of complicated. Plus you'd said
totally complicated, yeah, but totally cool.
Plus you would say that you have to spin them up, but you don't keep them spinning. Is that correct?
You spin them as long as you want to move, and then when you want to stop moving, you stop spinning it. Yeah, I mean, it's just like a reaction wheel, just three times more dimensional.
Yeah, exactly. I think that's what's tripping me up, is that it's a sphere. That's so weird, but
yeah.
Cool.
Well, yeah, a 3D motor. I've never heard of that. Like, that's so cool.
So yeah, just those two highlights. But lots of other projects going on, and some pretty cool ones too. I just didn't mention them. I suppose we don't have too much time. But check out the article in the show notes and take a look at all the cool stuff that NASA is partnering with these other companies, most of which, or I should say at least many of which, I've never even heard of. Just like I've never heard of that first one, like Tethers Unlimited. I didn't know who they were.
Oh, they're so cool.
But there's a bunch of companies out there like that that do all kinds of cool stuff.
Yep.
You kind of really can't appreciate just how many different organizations are involved until you look closely, because I mean, me, it's like SpaceX, Northrop Grumman, Virgin Galactic. No, there's like hundreds out there that are doing all kinds of cool stuff. Second story, back again, Akatsuki, the Japanese Venusian probe, or would-be Venusian probe. It takes a second run at a Venus capture.
So we talked about this earlier this year, I believe. So back in December 2010, Akatsuki tried to capture around Venus, but there was a valve failure and some salt built up, and the engine overheated and destroyed their main propulsion system. So instead of doing their actual capture burn, they basically just put themselves into a weird orbit. So I did a couple tweaks and figured out that they could circle around the sun three times with a low perihelion. And if they timed it just right, Venus would show back up and they would meet up with Venus a second time. So they had to deal with very, very high temperatures, higher than they were expecting when they built the thing, because they weren't expecting to go this close to the sun. And they're having to do all of their correction burns with their secondary orientation thrusters, which, you know, are really just there to bleed off angular momentum when their gyros get going too fast, I believe. They're not even really like reaction control thrusters because they've got these gyros. So Venus comes around. We're getting ready to take a second shot. They have completed their final correction burn and it was successful. So far, they've done burns up to 10 minutes. Their capture burn is going to be 20 minutes and they think that that's going to be totally fine. They're pretty confident with what they've done so far. So that final capture is going to happen on December 7th, which is coming up. So get ready to check that out. And that is the news for Akatsuki.
Well, what happens after that? I don't remember now. Are they going to just orbit Venus?
Yeah, they're going to orbit Venus. They were originally going to be in a pretty low circular orbit. That's out of the question now. So they're going to capture into a very eccentric orbit, and then they're going to do a couple of extra burns to bring their apoapsis down. They were expecting to orbit Venus once every like 10 hours or so, which is, you know, a really low orbit given that Venus is about the same size as Earth. But instead, they're going to be on a 15-day period orbit initially, and then they're going to drop it down to, I think, 10 days or something like that. They're bringing it down, but they're still going to be in a super high orbit. But they're going to be able to do all their science, hopefully.
That's pretty high, though. I mean, if Venus has about the same gravity as Earth, I'm going to take a wild stab and say it's about like 100,000 kilometers or at least 100,000 kilometers out. So they're pretty far away, because 10 days, that's, you know, less than halfway to the moon. But as far as, you know, like the orbital period, I'm just really crunching bad numbers.
Yeah, it's like going from low Earth orbit up to halfway up to the moon.
So they're pretty far out. I don't recall exactly what kind of instrumentation this thing has.
It was mostly light observation, I believe.
Okay, because, yeah, Venus has that thick atmosphere, and I'm just wondering what they're going to be able to get out of it, considering the orbit and all that kind of stuff.
So. We'll see. Well, I mean, their periapsis is pretty low, so, you know, they're not exactly going to... Their periapsis is probably going to be on the nighttime side, given the way that they're approaching it. I don't know. We'll find out.
Okay, stand by. We're looking at it.
Questions, comments, and correction burns. We have no correction burns, but we have a few things that we would like to share with you. The first one is, and I don't know where you found this, by the way, but a brief history of rocket launches.
Yeah, so this actually came off of Reddit. This is from Nathaniel Guy, and it wasn't off of Reddit. He emailed me. So Nathaniel took a crack at guessing this week in Space Flight History, and he actually wrote in just a bit too late because we had recorded a day early, and he said, well, you know, I guessed by using this little utility that I had built. So he sends me a link to the utility, and this is really cool. So this is on github.io, and it's called, like you said, A Brief History of Rocket Launches, and it's just a world map, and when you hit play, it plays every single rocket launch and puts a little dot on the map for it and codes that dot whether the mission was successful or not. It displays a list on the side for everything, and you can choose a time period to start at, and you can choose a run speed, and it's really cool.
For me, more than anything, it kind of illustrates how rocket launches how the frequency of rocket launches has, you know, progressed over time, because you see that there are more and more dots as time goes on.
Yeah.
And it just gives you a good idea of all the various launch sites throughout the world. So obviously a lot of them are more or less mostly equatorial.
And it's cool watching those pop up over time as well.
Yeah, you just see it grow and grow and grow. I suppose soon enough there's going to be a little dot in East Texas, right? a few other places. But yeah, it's a neat little application. It says, so this is on GitHub, is that right?
Yeah, it's on GitHub.
So is it an application? Is it like,
yeah,
you know,
yeah,
an
it's a little web app. Yeah, github.io allows you to build something in a GitHub repository and then run it on one of their servers. And so that when you see github.io, it's all little web apps.
All right, and then the next thing we have here is Stan Draws Spaceships. So this is a YouTube channel that you came across.
This is so good.
It kind of reminds me of Minute Physics, if anyone out there is familiar with Minute Physics.
Yeah, it's like a more energetic Minute Physics, because his animation style is so good. It's stripped down to the very basics, but everything looks so recognizable, and he doesn't really talk about what any of these rockets are. He doesn't say their names, but you can tell what each one is, and it's so beautiful, and he's so excited about what he's talking about, and it's just perfect. So yeah, I ran across this one on Reddit. It's so, so good. Stanley is actually a very accomplished animator and graphic designer. He's not a nobody, and that's why he is so good at this. And I was actually really bummed to find out that he's as well respected as he is, because I was hoping we could get him to come do some art for the show or something, but I don't think that's going to happen.
His videos, because this is, I think, yeah, this is the first. So this is, the channel is called Stan Draws Spaceships. And so far we just have the first video, but I think as it goes on, he's going to try to explain some very basic, you know, like aerospace concepts through these little animations, which is kind of like what this podcast sometimes ostensibly does.
What we would like to do.
I just think it's a great reference. It's something that you can point someone to and say, this will explain exactly how orbits work or, you know, how this or that or the other thing works.
And not only does it do that, but it does it without making any big mistakes, right? Because so many people explain this stuff and they explain it well, but there's some representation that just doesn't feel right. And this, everything works. All of the orbits are actual parabolic orbits, and all the hardware looks like actual hardware, and it's so good. It's so, so satisfying.
So this week we have a guest with us, and his name is Tim Dodd. And Tim, why don't you tell us a little bit about yourself and what we might be discussing on this episode.
Okay. Well, I'm a professional photographer from Cedar Falls, Iowa. I shoot rocket launches occasionally for spaceflightnow.com. And I run a Instagram account called Everyday Astronaut. And it's something I've been working on for the past 2 years. It's kind of a silly art project, I guess. It's also has some like hidden STEM meanings and a lot of things, and pushes for education and just entertainment.
Okay, interesting. So yeah, let me ask you right off the bat then, that you said it was an Instagram account?
Yeah, so Everyday Astronaut is the name of the account. Yeah, nice and simple, all one word. And it's something that I've only had that account handle actually for about a year, but I've been working on the project for almost 2 years now. I bought a random online, I saw an auction for a vintage Russian high altitude flight suit that looks a lot like the shuttle, the non-pressurized shuttle suits, you know, Challenger. And, so I just started shooting a whole bunch of random pictures of me in it, and people started really responding well to it, like on my Facebook and stuff. And I was like, you know, I might be onto something here, and just kind of haven't stopped. Yeah.
It's a pretty cool collection of photos, because you're right. It's everything. If you name a pose or an action, you probably got it. And I definitely thought that was a shuttle pumpkin suit until I looked really close.
Yep. It's probably most likely from like a MiG or something like that, you know, in the 80s, I'm guessing.
Is it an actual flight suit or was it a test article?
It is an actual flight suit, but I don't know any of the history on it.
Oh, that's kind of unfortunate.
It's kind of creepy.
So you got this at an auction, you said?
Yeah. It was this website called rrauction.com. And at the time they had like hundreds and hundreds of quote unquote space relics. And, I was looking for stuff that hadn't been bid on, you know, it's just like, oh, what can I afford? You know, there's like lunar module, you know, consoles and like all these really cool things. And they're going for $10,000-$20,000. And I'm like, what, you know, and I'm looking at, you can actually filter by lowest price, you know? So I was looking at that, and it was like at the very end of the auction, no one had bid on this lone Russian cosmonaut suit thing, and I'm like, oh, why not? So it was $300.
If that is a genuine suit and you only pay $300, I would say that's a huge bargain, because those things have to cost a lot more.
Helmet alone I see on eBay between like $1,000 and $1,500 pretty often.
So you decided to take it around the world and like run through water with it.
like literally pretty much ruin it. I mean, it is in shambles. It smells horrible. It originally had this really thick rubber lining on the inside. And I actually ended up, so when it had the rubber lining, had these boots that I, you know, wear with it. And originally it weighed like almost 30 pounds, together, which is a pain in the butt when you're traveling alone with that. And then all my camera gear and luggage, it just became insane. And that rubber lining was so hot. Like I can't even begin to describe how sweat, I couldn't wear it for more than 5 minutes, literally. So I finally cut that out this summer. I took the rubber lining out, and that was one of the smartest things I've ever done, because now the suit's a lot more manageable and I can actually stay in it for more than 5 minutes.
So I'm actually flipping through Everyday Astronaut, and you've got one of you trying to climb up on top of the Enterprise. Is that right? And how much trouble did you get in for doing that?
Actually, none, because a lot of those older shots were just all Photoshop. So I would, you know, do my best to make it look as lit. So like that one, it would have been much easier to reach up and try to climb the shuttle, the orbiter, than it was what I ended up doing, which was climbing on a friend's, he has this really big two-story like living room, and I was climbing up on his closet, and he got up on a ladder and shot from a similar view, so the vantage point was the same. You know, like, it would have been so much easier if I could have just climbed the stupid thing in the first place, you know?
Is the wing within reaching distance? Because...
Oh, probably not, no.
I'm guessing your scale must be wrong, because I can't imagine it being that low and not be covered in, like, smeary, like, peanut butter and jelly handprints.
Right. It is... If I remember right, you know, cause you can walk underneath it. I think you could jump up and touch it. If you jumped really, you know, it is a solid 10 feet probably, but, I'm not exactly sure. I'm sure someone out there knows that exact distance. Well, it's 13.19.
Well, you've already said that it's, but it's Photoshop. So
yeah.
Nobody's going to tell you, well, you can't do that. Yeah.
I see a photo here of you sitting on top of, and you're in the suit, and you're sitting on, I think, what is the Great Wall of China? Mm-hmm. Is that what that is?
Yep. And wow. So I'm lucky enough to have a friend that lives in Beijing, and he took me out to a really remote area that I feel like mostly only locals would know about, where it's all, you know, completely falling apart, complete ruins. And so we hiked for the full day. We ended up hiking for 8 hours and like a 5 mile loop. It was crazy, and we didn't see anyone else out there except for one other hiking group the whole day, which was really cool. So that was really surreal to me, because I've always wanted to see the Great Wall, but I always assumed the only thing you could ever see as a tourist would be just the place, you know, where like the bus drops you off and there's 2,000 people running around on it and it's perfect condition and stuff. So it was really cool to be able to see the actual ruins and climb around on them.
So while we're on the topic, did you really quick want to talk about that video that you sent us?
Yeah, sure. So I was in Myanmar in April, working with a new startup nonprofit called Global Populous. And their idea is they send photojournalists or journalists to a location, and instead of donating, trying to, you know, build a house or like being a doctor, which a journalist isn't a doctor, or instead of just donating like food directly, you go and then you produce a story and you tell that story to people around the world, which I think is a really cool concept, just to kind of close that gap. You know, living in 2015, I feel like it's really easy to be able to connect with someone if you see a film of them or pictures and stories and whatnot. It just kind of makes the world feel smaller. So that's kind of their concept. So yeah, I went there to produce a film, and I did a little bit for them, and now I'm working on my own version of that film, which is fictional, and it's actually about, I think she's a 9 or 10 year old girl that wants to be an astronaut. And so I produced this whole little short film, and I haven't quite got it finished to be able to premiere it yet, but I'm really close, within the next week or two probably.
And what are you going to do with that video?
I'm reaching out to people right now. So if anyone out there has a good idea, some kind of STEM aligned, someone that might care for education, women's education, and third world country education, things like that. Any kind of outreach like that, I think it'd be fun to co-premiere it with them. I've just sent a blanket email out to like Planetary Society and a few other nonprofits. Just hoping to see if someone else would want to co-premiere it, but I guess I'll probably just throw it up on Reddit and watch it get ruined, because no one watches a video on Reddit.
Yeah, that's kind of what happens.
Yeah.
But it was a fantastic video. Thank you. You sent us a preliminary version of it, and it looks really good, and it's kind of one of those things that doesn't, it has a message behind it, but it's kind of just art for the sake of being art, and it was just really beautiful, and I really liked it. And you said that you did the soundtrack for it and everything. It's really cool.
Yeah, thank you. So I'm trying to make it so it's short enough that people can actually watch it, because I know the attention span of an average human being right now seems to be about 7 seconds, or probably a vine. So I have it at 2 minutes and 30 seconds or so, and I'm hoping that I can get enough people to watch it at that length to get excited about it and pass it on, because I feel like it could have a cool impact, for especially for young kids and kids that live in regions where, I guess, outside of a first world country, if it can. So hopefully it does make it back to them. I will deliver them a version of the film, but outside of them, even I feel like other kids in Myanmar, other kids in wherever, Thailand or whatever, if they see it, hopefully they can relate to it as well. And it can be an encouragement. So
awesome.
One more thing, if I could add one more thing about the Everyday Astronaut account. So the very original series that I posted on Reddit did really well. But one thing that people I don't think quite notice is I hid a ton of space facts in there.
Oh.
And some people did kind of pick up on it and they're looking for certain things. But even things like wake up timers for STS-135, is the very first shot was called Good Morning World. And I have my hand on a clock and the clock is the actual wake up alarm timer. For 135, for when they were about to, on their last day on the space shuttle. And I hid things all over the place. I kind of went from like the very first U.S. space flight, manned space flight from U.S. soil, and the last in that same picture. So there's also an EKG of Alan Shepard sitting on the, his EKG reading from the first Mercury mission. And so I hit a bunch of weird things and a lot of people didn't even pick up on all the hidden meanings, which I thought, well, I had kind of fun with that. And like,
well, now I got to go back through all these and look for them. Yeah. That's really cool.
So I think the best way to do that, because you do want to see them in the high resolution, it's not going to be through Instagram. It'd probably be, I'll send you a better link of something with higher resolution, probably the original Imgur, I don't know.
Boy, I don't even know.
Yeah.
Okay, cool. Yeah, we'll put that in the show notes for anybody who's interested in going on a
scavenger hunt.
A scavenger hunt. Yeah, that's the word I was looking for.
Yeah, it's fun.
So in this episode, we have not yet talked about SpaceX. And when I was talking to you about what kind of things we want to talk about in the show, you said, well, I could just sit and talk about SpaceX for ages. So do you want to just sit and talk about SpaceX for a little bit?
Yeah, you'll have to cut us off, I think, because this might go for hours.
So have you seen any launches?
Funnily enough, the very first launch I was ever supposed to shoot was CRS-3, which got scrubbed and pushed back like 5 times. And so I ended up leaving a camera on the pad. It got scrubbed 40 minutes before it was supposed to launch and I already had a flight and it wasn't going to launch for another like 3 days. And so I was like, I can't stick around for 3 more days. So I just left my camera out on the pad. So my camera saw the launch, but I have not seen a SpaceX flight actually.
Well, what happened to your camera?
So I ended up Justin at Spaceflight Now ended up retrieving it for me, sending it back to me and getting the pictures back for me.
Did you have this thing on a timer or?
Yeah. So when we do launches, we're straying already from SpaceX, but this is an interesting topic. How do you want to do this? Do you want to
go for it. Yeah. That's
okay.
Fine.
So when the close up pictures you see from the pad that are, you know, within 10 to hundreds of feet, you know, those are triggered by sound. So there is a sound trigger. A lot of people make their own Adreno weird, you know, weird boards that they make themselves, or you can buy certain kits that have a sound trigger on it. And you just set the threshold really high so that, you know, something well over 100 decibels will trigger it and it'll actually wake the camera up and just start firing away. And that's how you get those shots without being there.
I did not know that. That's cool.
I had never experienced anything like that before until I got kind of invited to start doing these launches. And I was like, oh, and I bought a bunch of them. And yeah,
it's great. Because one thing I noticed when I did the little tour of the Kennedy Space Center for CRS-6, I think it was CRS-6, and you know, you can walk pretty close, like pretty close. You can get right up to that launch pad, but there's a little fence that surrounds it. And so there's tons of cameras set up and there's no one manning them. You know, I was thinking it must be done remotely or something, because obviously you can't have any people like anywhere near that launch. You have to be, I think, a minimum of 3 miles away. Yep. For civilians, maybe some of the other personnel can get a little bit closer.
Yeah.
But there's tons of these cameras everywhere and there's just nobody there with them. And so I thought, how do they know when to hit the start button?
So you can't do it radio waves either because of potential interference from
ground control
and all that stuff too. So everything is in a self-contained unit, basically just something that plugs into the camera's remote trigger. And then it stays on. They can stay on for days. I left that out there for 3 or 4 days with literally nothing but a garbage bag on it. So you just wrap it in a garbage bag to keep it from the rain and the moisture physically ruining the camera. But, there's nothing to protect it from the blast of the rocket. And EFT-1 was one of those, the first flight demonstration of Orion, a Delta IV Heavy produces a huge amount of thrust coming off the pad and everything within about 100 feet radius is just leveled. And so people had their cameras missing. They had tripods sheared in half. They found their tripods or cameras stuck in the fence like a quarter mile away.
Wow.
Just crazy stuff. I happen to not have any problems, but a lot of people had their bags melted on into their cameras and stuff like that. It was, and they were talking 10 feet from my camera. People were having like things going on, and I happened to be really lucky with one of those triggered cameras to not have any problems, but I think I was pretty lucky.
So with CRS3, how did your camera not run out of battery? Were you given an external power supply?
So no, it just goes to sleep after a minute or two or whatever, and the camera will, you know, it just basically is off at that point. And luckily, with at least with Canons, the trigger itself that stays on top is a separate unit that runs on AA's, and that can stay on standby for several days.
Right.
And it will start, you know, going for it no matter what, and start sending out that signal as soon as the threshold gets breached. So even if it's 3 days later, it'll start trying to shoot pictures. And after the first picture gets shot, it'll wake the camera up from sleep. And the
camera... that's really good engineering on Canon's part. I own a couple of Canon cameras, yes, and I've always used them at work. And so I, you know, have a certain level of appreciation for that. But I didn't realize that in their sleep mode, they could last for so long and still monitor.
Well, it's just like if you leave your camera out on a desk for 5 minutes and pick it up and click the shutter button halfway, it'll wake back up from sleep almost instantly.
Yeah, but I didn't realize that it was in a deep enough sleep that it could run on its battery.
Oh, right. It's really pretty much off, which is cool. Yeah, which is very fortunate for us trying to do things like this. I think it's a huge coincidence, but yeah, it's awesome.
That's pretty cool. So are you only using Arduinos, or do you have...
I use these things called... I don't even remember their name anymore. It's some small brand... Trigger Trap, I think is what it's called. Most people don't use these quote-unquote trigger traps. They think they're kind of garbage, but I've had great luck with them. I haven't had any problems. These other people use these much cooler ones. No, I have a Nero or something like that. Not a trigger trap. Everyone wants the trigger traps, and I don't have them. These guys are such dorks about everything, even dorkier than me, which is saying a ton.
You know, people get passionate about things. Like, I'm never going to fault somebody for that.
Well, I mean, it's to the point where it affects, like, their handshaking abilities sometimes. You know what I'm saying?
No, what does that mean?
Come on, you know, when you run into, like, people that are, like, such foamers about a certain issue that they have no more social skills, and they go for handshakes, and they miss and hit your elbow, and you're just like, oh.
I never thought of it that way, but okay.
That's not all of them. There's just a couple out there that you're like, oh, why? But actually, there's a lot of really cool guys out there that I've had a lot of fun meeting and becoming friends with. But yeah, but there's just, you know, there's a few, just like everything, when you start, you know, train fans or car fans or people that are super into it. Yeah.
Just people who are somewhere on the spectrum, I guess you could say.
Yeah, exactly.
Which I might be one of them, so I'm not going to, you know, I have no room to talk.
Well, when I shake your hand, I'll judge you.
Although I know nothing about cameras, so I'm safe there.
That's true.
Okay, so you want to go back to SpaceX? Something I do know a little bit about. So this might be a really obvious question, but what is it that gets you so excited about SpaceX?
I think for me, it's the fact that so many people are doubting whether or not they're going to be able to recover a first stage. Mm-hmm. That's an industry faux pas almost, of people going, oh, you're wasting your time, energy, your engineering. Why does it matter almost? And that's finally someone reaching out and trying to get beyond where we're at. Rockets for the past 60 years have functioned in the exact same manner, basically. You know, mm-hmm. they go up and they fall back, and that's it. And I think I'm just excited because he's such a visionary as far as not only can this potentially save a lot of money, make spaceflight a lot more affordable, but it's just so badass too. Like,
oh, so
it's
you're not
so
a SpaceX
cool.
fan, you're an Elon Musk fan.
Both,
yeah.
Because I mean, because it's Elon's push that is the one that's, let's make these things recoverable for the implications of reusability, you know, the cost savings, and also for Mars. He knows that looking forward, but I don't see any other companies until they started this big initiative. Now we have Blue Origin, we have...
Yeah, isn't that interesting?
It is. I just see it as like, we're going to look back at this and it's going to be almost a revolution as far as we're going to look back and go, can you remember when we just threw rockets away? We just thought they were impossible to recover.
Do you remember when even on the small rocket launches, we'd throw the entire thing away, even the small ones?
Yeah. And I just feel like that's something where it's like, we're just going to look back at that. And SpaceX is going to be looked at as the company that was really, really, really pushing for that and saw that as probably the biggest threshold keeping us from progressing. And that's, I think that's what gets me really excited, is the fact that we might just be getting space that much more closer to home for all of us, you know?
Yeah. That's the thing that excites me the most as well, is that we're talking about reusable, or, you know, potentially reusable vehicles. And that, I think more than anything, that's what excites me about SpaceX. I think if it were just, hey, we're making rockets and a new Dragon spacecraft, I probably wouldn't care as much. But when they say reusable, that's a game changer.
Right.
And I can't even fathom how that's going to actually manifest itself and how that's going to affect the industry. We just don't know at this point, but
exactly.
It's an exciting time.
Well, I have to say CRS-3, which was April 2013, I barely knew who SpaceX was. I knew it was quote unquote Elon Musk's silly rocket project almost, you know? And then when I got there and to the launch and saw it and realized that, oh, those landing legs are there because they're going to try and recover this thing eventually. Like, that's when the gears really started turning for me. And that's when I got really excited about it. Before that, it was just another rocket. But that's what made it just that much cooler to me.
Wasn't CRS-3 the first flight with landing legs?
Yes, it was. Yep.
Yeah. So you kind of.
I caught the bug right as it was happening, really, you know. And before that, I didn't care, didn't really pay attention, and now all of a sudden, yeah.
Is there somewhere we can see your CRS-3 photography?
Yeah, I'm sure on Spaceflight Now, I'll be able to send you guys that show link, but yeah, that was the first one that I shot for them, so.
Well, and then you've done some really cool stuff looking at the ASDS, is that right?
Yeah, I did, yeah.
I don't know, it was like last month, we started talking, and you're like, hey, I don't know if you've ever heard of me, my name's Tim Dodd. And I was like, oh my God, yes, I know who you are because of this drone imagery, right? What kind of drone was that?
That was a DJI Inspire 1.
Oh, of course it was.
And
So can you tell us about this footage that you shot?
I was kind of hush-hush about it for like weeks because I was so nervous I was totally breaking laws. And to be honest, I still am not sure the legality.
I don't think anybody's sure.
I kept it within line of sight. I was outside of 5 miles of my airport. I stayed under 400 feet. So as far as FAA laws go, I think I was okay. But I was flying over federal seaport, which gets kind of, who knows, you know,
yeah.
Who really knows with this stuff. But I wasn't flying over crowds of people. I think my biggest risk was potentially just losing, you know, at the time it was a, you know, $3,000 drone. But I don't know if I would have been in huge legal trouble. But I was down in Florida for, it was just some Delta IV launch that I was shooting. And I ran up to Jacksonville because I thought, hey, you know, maybe I could see if ASDS is there. Of course, I still love you is there. Or wait, no, just read the instructions. Yeah, just read the instructions. Yeah. So I got on the SpaceX subreddit. I found almost exactly where it was parked. People gave me a pretty good idea. I look it up and I drive up there. And when I first saw it, you know, when you get like that big adrenaline rush that makes you scared, where like you're kind of shaking because you're like, I don't know if I should do this. It was 100%. I mean, I drove back and forth like 3 times going, should I do it? Should I do it? There's no one there. I could totally do this, but.
So you must have parked right outside the dock then.
I parked on the other side of this little bridge. There was like a little place where I could kind of park down alongside where it seems like a lot of fishermen go or something. And so I was actually kind of hidden, which was nice from the road and from their point of view. But I could still see. I kind of walked under the bridge and watched my flight the whole time. So it was probably 400 feet or maybe a little more, maybe half a mile from it. And yeah, it was horrifying.
Are you planning on viewing any other space or filming any other SpaceX launches? Because there's a couple of exciting ones coming up. I guess next year is when they're doing Falcon Heavy, right?
So
first quarter,
supposedly. Yeah, I'm not going to hold my breath on Falcon Heavy.
Yeah. You're probably,
you know,
right.
I want to see that more than anything, but I'm not going to plan around it because it's just too hard to know, especially a new system like that. Who knows how many times they're going to scrub and hold the date and keep pushing it back. But I'm tempted. I'm going to be down in the south. I'm going to be going to Houston and hopefully Michoud or whatever assembly outside of
Michoud. I'm not sure how they say
I've only read it. I've never heard it said. So, but I'm probably going to be going down there here in December. And if that RTF of SpaceX ends up being like December 15th,
which it might,
I know, then that might be really hard for me not to go down there. But I don't know. I feel like they're going to have all their ducks in a row. So I don't think they're going to have to scrub. I don't think they're going to have any helium leaks. I think since they've had 6 months to re-engineer and look over every little detail, I think this is going to be like the most solid rocket they've probably ever produced just because they can't risk it. They can't have anything, any oversight. So I have a feeling it's going to roll out on the pad. It's going to go up. and it's going to go off right on their, you know, their first initial real true date, you know. So yeah, I kind of have an open invite to go down whenever I can, but being Iowa, it's not exactly the most convenient place.
Yeah,
to
Iowa's
live.
not the best place to be a spaceflight photographer, I
no,
guess.
No, there's not a lot of rockets up here.
Which is funny because like I'm in Northern California and like, you wouldn't think that that would be too great either, but we've got Boeing, and we've got, if I decide to fly south, I can go down to Vandenberg.
Right.
And then, you know, we've got, all the test stands are still around from the S4B, and, you know, right. Like it's kind of a random place to see a lot of space, but I don't think that there's anything like that in Iowa.
No, there's actually, oddly enough, out like 5 miles from me, there's actually a company that builds the big, it's like part movers that they use for, actually they're using it for SLS assembly right now. They put the tanks on these huge like truck things that can move in any direction. They can raise and lower. And I didn't realize that until about a year and a half ago, this company right outside my doorstep does some contract work for NASA. So it's kind of cool. Yeah. So even though there is nothing space related here at all, there is that, I guess.
Yeah. It must have been Saturn V where they were boasting about how parts came from like 49 states or something like that.
Yeah, I think that sounds right because there's a manufacturing plant that was basically strewn into absolutely every corner of our country.
Yeah.
But, and that was kind of the beauty and the flaw of it because, yeah, it kept Congress, you know, happy to keep it funded because it was, right. Everyone's like, yeah, but it's also terribly inefficient to have to ship things all around the country for, yeah.
Yep.
So as far as SpaceX goes, though, I do really, 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 I assume we still haven't heard for sure, but we're 99% sure at this point, right, that they're probably going to land on their drone ship for this return to flight. But I would love nothing more than to try and make it down for the first time they turn around and come home.
I think I'd be happy just if they landed on the drone ship successfully. I mean,
yeah, oh, that's going to be a real trip.
That will.
And anything more than that is just icing on the cake. But yeah, so this one is probably going to be a drone landing or an attempted landing on the drone ship. But then the next one, I think the very next flight is the JSON satellite launch, right, Ben?
Yeah.
The other one. And that one, I think you're saying they're going to try to land that one back on a landing pad.
We're hoping JSON's going to be the next one. There's some question which one's going to come next, but yeah, JSON's flying out of Vandenberg that one, they really, really wanted to land back on land, which is kind of funny because I didn't realize that they had a landing pad out at Vandenberg, but apparently they've got something set up.
Yeah, and I think that one was done and already. We've kind of been hearing about that for a while, I think.
Yeah.
And the Kennedy Space Center one, I think, is just getting finished. I still haven't heard officially if that's...
They said that it was they were done pouring concrete like last month.
Okay.
So I haven't heard anything beyond that, but I mean, how much more can you do? You gotta paint some lines and
you really don't want much out there, you know, anything out there in the path of that thing. It's probably bad. So
yeah, you don't put China out there.
I guess all you need is just a big concrete slab. That's about it. Maybe some other landing lights or cameras, whatever. I don't know.
Fire extinguisher or two.
Yeah. Fire extinguisher.
And I bet they'll have some kind of beacon, like a precise homing beacon thing that it can bounce telemetry off of or something.
I would be kind of surprised if they did that, to be honest, because I think they want most of the tracking elements to be off of the spaceship just for weight. Being able to actually find a single signal is kind of difficult. I think it's easier to just triangulate off of a couple of GPS satellites. I could be wrong about that, but
I have no idea. Yeah, that sounds possible.
I could see them putting a tracking station out there and sending it some data, but
right. Yeah, I'm not sure. I'm curious as to when that is officially online. But the coolest thing is, as photographers, is so you actually sometimes get the opportunity to go up on the top of the vehicle assembly building. That big, you know, the big iconic 40 whatever story building. And from there, you can see the entire complex really easily. So you'd be able to sit there and actually photograph it returning, which would just be the coolest thing in the entire world.
Yeah. You know, I would risk putting a camera pretty close to that pad.
Yeah. And that's SpaceX is really, 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 they don't like let you go outside of what they say you do. You get like an hour to set up cameras tops. Maybe sometimes it's been like 20 minutes. It'll say, okay, here's your window, go. And then you have to like set up your cameras and like, okay, you're done. And, so I cannot picture that. Like, I can absolutely see them saying no cameras near the launch pad or pointing at the launch pad or something like
yeah,
that.
Yeah, you know? Well, especially because if they have a failure, they want to be able to control that. You know, they'll put their own video out, but they want to put it out when they want to put it out.
For sure. And it's so easy for people, you know, the media or whatever, to grab images of a blowing up rocket and use it out of context and say SpaceX fails. And it's like, no, this was huge. Like, this is awesome.
Yeah. Nobody's ever failed in quite this way before.
Yeah. This is a great failure. Even the fact that it touches where it's supposed to touch, granted blowing up, like, that's fine by me. You're doing a great job. Yeah. Something that I would love to see them do is have a return to home, but still have them land on the drone ship, but like, 500, 600, 1,000 feet away from shore, just as like the, you know, so they get the boost back burn, all that stuff, but they don't quite have that risk of sending it completely over land, but it's just, you know, that extra little bit. Cause I feel like the boost.
Oh, back you mean burn just moving the drone ship closer to home?
Yeah. Like right off the shore, right off the coast.
Yeah. That's a good idea. That's a pretty good incremental step. I wonder if they'll feel they need another increment though. And of course there was always, there's always talk of, refueling on the drone ship, which is something that Elon said a while back. He said that he wanted to refuel on the drone ship, which kind of blew my mind. I can't imagine them
wanting to waste, you know, 7 minutes or whatever for two and a half minutes more of engine burn time, though, just to fly it home. And then the potential risk, you know? Like,
yeah, but the thing is, like, you could put that drone ship so far out to sea that you could barely save any fuel because you don't have to do the boost back burn, which is a huge amount of fuel to do. And, you know, potentially you could save even that little extra bit, but then you have to deal with, you know, salt water and a boat.
But I'm just thinking, why don't they just ship it back then? It's on a ship.
Well, because you want rapid reusability, because shipping it back is going to take forever. You'd also have to have another ship out there, because the drone ship is not going to be able to float back with that thing on top without it falling off.
Right.
And also, the longer it's exposed to salt water, air, the worse it is. I mean, that stuff is corrosive as anything, and just being a couple feet away from the ocean can destroy an engine.
So for this first one, they're hoping to, when they recover their first one on the ship, they will be shipping that one back in, though, obviously, right? And I heard someone say, like, they're going to weld the feet down and stuff. Have you heard that?
Really? I have not heard that.
I don't think they're going to be able to weld the feet down.
There's got to be a more elegant way.
So at one point they had talked about installing like booties that you could strap down over the feet.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, I can't imagine them putting somebody on that ship long enough to do a really good weld. But yeah, I mean, they're going to have to ship it back somehow. And who knows, that drone ship has got insane thrusters on it, so it may be able to keep itself level enough. You know, even though it'll be bouncing up and down, they may be able to just toot-toot, drive back home. Well, and, you know, they may just go, okay, cool, we landed, now tip it off. Who knows?
No, because they're gonna want to tear it apart and start seeing what needs to be re-engineered and things like that, reevaluated and all that stuff.
They might be looking for wear. But, I mean, they do stand tests. They do full-duration stand tests. I don't know why that would be any different.
Right.
Well, because you have the whole rocket. I mean, they don't do stand tests that but they can't, there's no way to subject a first stage to all of the stresses that you would get on an actual launch on a test stand.
Yeah,
I mean, you can burn the engines, but that's about it.
Well, even the fact that, you know, they've never ever had a rocket that has actually, you know, done its full acceleration, which is 6 or 8 G's or whatever, that normally just gets lost to the ocean anyway. So they never get, you know, an engineer, just forget the fact of landing. An engineer's never really been able to see the stresses. They just over-engineer, I think. And there could be places where they go, look, why do we have this? This didn't even get affected or whatever. You know, this is total overkill. Let's strap this. Or look, this almost broke. You know, maybe they would have seen the fault with the strut. That was stage two. But
yeah, but something like that.
But something
really
like that, you know.
Exactly.
Yeah, that's a good point.
So it's an exciting engineering case, you know, for them just to be able to actually do something they've never done before.
Yeah. I think that once they recover that stage, that's like the most important piece of, I guess you could say, forensic launch evidence that they could ever have, you know. That is going to inform how they do the next launch, because that's when they can start fine-tuning all of the, you know, because just as you said, there are things that they might not need to do, that they're adding too much shielding or whatever there.
Yeah.
They don't need this and they do need that. It's just so important to have that, because you need that. You just need to have that data set, and no one has anything like that really, because all rocket stages go in the ocean.
Yeah.
I can't think of any exceptions to that actually. Or they crash on land, you know, they scatter into a million pieces. Like, that's how the Chinese do it, but so I don't know. I don't know what kind of viable, like, you know, information you can get from that. So,
yeah.
So yeah, it'll be interesting. I can't wait myself.
Oh,
fingers crossed. I'm feeling just as nervous about this as I am about, well, we were talking about last week, the whatchamacallit. Yeah, that thing. The one that's being launched on the Atlas V, the orbital ATK.
Oh, right.
Why can't I think? Yes. Cygnus. Latin for swan, I think. So I'm kind of nervous about that just because it's their first flight back, and I'm going to feel the same way about CRS, whatever. What is it?
Seven.
I think it's seven.
Yep.
Yeah, seven. Well, seven was
the failure.
Failure. So do they keep it? Do they still call it CRS-7?
I think that...
No, it'll be CRS-8 when they have another resupply mission, right?
I would think so. Well, or do they do like CRS-7A?
No. It will be 8 because they get paid for that launch whether or not they delivered it.
Sweet. I've got
so it's not like they're going to add an extra mission on. It'll be CRS-8.
I have a quick side note. I got distracted this week looking at, you mentioned crashing first stages, you know, like China does over land. I had never looked at the Cosmodome, looking at the downrange first stage jettison boosters, just crashing. It crashes into farmland and stuff there too. I never, you know, even today, this still happens. There's still villages that like, they're just like, oh yeah, rockets fall on us.
Yeah, I know. It seems like, well, I think that the government does try to avoid that, but some, you know, things do go down fairly close to populated areas.
Yeah. I mean, there's pictures all over the place and people that go out and they recover and salvage these parts and stuff too, even they'll melt down the metal and take them in as their own. It sounds super, how Star Wars-esque or something is that? That sounds so science fiction. There's communities that just recycle the crash first stages of rockets, you know? It's just insane.
Well, I think what's even more insane is that people are happy to let rockets rain down on their farmland because they know they'll be able to sell off some high quality metal. Like I think that says more about humanity than. So yeah, I went to the CRS-8 Wikipedia page and there is the top photo on there is a render of a dragon being birthed to the nadir port of what is that? Node 3, whatever node 3 is. And the PMA is upside down.
Yeah, it's actually Harmony, it says right there.
Oh, is it Harmony? Yeah.
Yeah.
The PMA is upside down.
Well,
I don't know why it's upside down.
Yeah, I suppose that's just a graphic that somebody put together with Photoshop.
Yeah,
and
that's,
they didn't
that's
quite get
not,
the orientation right.
Yeah, what's the name of the... Now I gotta look it up, because it's gonna bug me.
Uh-oh.
NASA's 3D model of the space station has a name. And it's actually funny, because it is a name.
John?
No, not John, it's like Brian or something.
Oh, really? It is just
a
name.
Guy's name. Jeff, the space station.
I think it should be Steve because that's an inherently funny name. I think it's because I watched a lot of Eddie Izzard and everyone's named Steve in his comedy bits.
That's true.
Hey, speaking of SpaceX, on the subreddit right now, someone's showing that they might have been doing a possible stage 2 test out at McGregor.
Really? Oh, man, I gotta go click over there. Oops, actually, I went to reddit.com/r/spa. And it's all in Norwegian. Oh, that's a very big cloud. Yeah, I can't think of what else that might be.
Have you guys heard, you know, obviously it sounds like the Falcon Heavy, it sounds like the center core will travel further than the boosters. From my understanding, right? The center core, because it's not cross.
Yeah, because that's the whole point of the boosters. Yeah.
Yeah. Have we heard yet if they're planning to hopefully launch from Brownsville then and have the center land in Florida somewhere?
I think I'm pretty sure I talked to somebody about this on Reddit, and it was somebody who has a tag on their name, basically meaning that I thought that they were worthy enough of remembering, but I don't remember exactly what it was. And they were saying that no, it's too much of a dogleg. You really only have one latitude that you can launch out of Boca Chica anyway, just because of the way that the islands and the south end of Florida line up. So if you were going to do that, you'd have to launch directly at Florida, which I mean would be really cool because that would get you almost perfectly straight east, right?
Right.
But, I think the rocket stage would still be too low to do that. But I wouldn't be surprised if they landed the boosters back at Boca Chica and then the core on a drone ship just off the coast of Florida or something like that.
Yeah, that'd be so cool. Again, I'm not holding my breath for that launch, but, when that happens, that's going to be so awesome.
So also, you are working on a children's book, is that right?
Yeah, that's right. So I've actually had a lot of people recommend that to me saying, you know, oh, your pic. I show my your Instagram account to my kids and they love it. And, you know, because my account's very silly and whimsical and clumsy and childish anyway. And that, I mean, that's been, those gears have been turning for over a year where I'm like, yeah, I really should do a children's book. Especially the first series is almost straight up would read like a children's book. If you read the first series with the captions below it, it almost already is a children's book. And so what I'm working on producing, and I'm just kind of in the very beginning stages of storyboarding and all that stuff, but here's a little behind the scenes, a little look at what I'm working on. If anyone wants to reach out and help me with some of these connections, that would be fantastic. Things are lining up pretty well, but it's kind of this morale of, you know, a clumsy astronaut that is excited to go to space and he's trying to go to space. He does all these rudimentary, almost Wile E. Coyote type of things, like using balloons to try and launch into space or using, you know, like a teeter totter or, you know, just all these silly things that obviously won't work, you know. And instead of giving up, he goes to the library and starts reading on, you know, like Rocket Science for Dummies is the first book that he reads. And then, you know, from there goes, man, I really need to learn more. And so I already have it lined up. I'm going to be shooting pictures at Mission Control Center at Johnson Space Center. I'm working on getting permission to go to Michoud or whatever we said it was. How do you say it?
It's clearly a French name, which would just be Michou, but I seriously doubt anyone says it that way.
Yeah. So I'm working on permissions for that. I'm in the process of that, but I hopefully am going to be taking pictures. My goal, my dream, my vision is to be standing there next to the Immensity, because they are actually starting to roll the tanks for SLS. You know, these things mm-hmm. are 40 foot in diameter, and just stand there and be able to, you know, kind of show off the immensity of this and the actual complications of spaceflight and go, you know, so I went to here and learned how they actually build rockets, you know, and then to show a picture of me, this tiny little speck next to this enormous tank. And then from there, I'm working on trying to get a few fun cameos that would be fun for adults, at least, for the parents reading it. So I'm working on, I've reached out to Buzz Aldrin this weekend, actually, because he's going to be, down in, an event in Oklahoma City that I might be attending.
He'll do it.
You think he'll do it?
He'll do it. Yeah.
That'd be amazing. So then you have that. Then like I was thinking from there, I could try to reach out to, you know, Bill Nye or Neil deGrasse Tyson, you know, and say, so then I talked to a scientist and he showed me this. Then I talked to a astrophysicist. He taught me this, you know, and just keep getting these little small cameos that would end up being a lot of a lot of fun for the adults, a lot of fun for me. And then that way you just get this book that parents get to read through it and they get something kind of fun out of it, you know. But kids also still have a morale of, you know, it takes a lot to do this and just kind of help line up and show that scale of how big this actually is, these projects are, how beyond any one person all this stuff is.
I love the idea of, because you're going to do this all in photos, right?
Yes.
Which is kind of unusual for a children's book. I mean, yeah. It's not, you know, out in left field like this has been done before, but I love the idea of doing that. And like, you've got such a good eye for the goofy, you know, like you can do that little bit of silliness, but it'll still all be in actual photos and right. actually hopefully showing off some, you know, real space hardware, which exactly. I'm always a big fan of.
Exactly.
Like those are all the things that could make a really good book, you know?
Yeah.
I think that's an awesome idea.
Yeah. I'm really excited about it because I feel like I already have honestly like 85-90% of the content shot. I've done, you know, I have a pretty big catalog to pull from. And then I just have to do these couple extra little things and hopefully write it up. And then I've never published anything before in my entire, I have no idea any of that. If anyone has any insight on that, you know, if they know any.
The one thing you could always do is just self-publish. That's what a lot of authors do these days.
Like even Amazon, I know it's pretty easy now. You can just send them the files and they'll give you an SKU and you say, here you go, which would be very easy. So yeah, so I'm just kind of starting that process. That's going to be my project over the winter once I'm done with my other work. And yeah, I'm really excited about it because I think it would be really cool. It'd be a book. I have nephews that are in a couple of my photographs and it's kind of for them. Just, you know, I can just picture them really enjoying it and being a part of it. And I have other friends with kids from the ages, you know, 3 to 7 type of thing would just be that great age where they're very impressionable. And that's when hobbies start to develop. Like my nephews, they build rocket ships all day long out of Legos now. Ever since I've kind of gone down this path of total dork, they've definitely picked up on that, and it's really cool to see their knowledge. It's awesome. It's just really cool.
That's really fantastic.
So I want to help push that, make it easier for parents that might not have any idea about this stuff yet, at least be able to get their kids excited.
Cool. Well, you know, if you know, whenever this happens, I'm trying to think, like, if you end up doing like crowdfunding or something like that, like let us know, because we'd love to keep our listeners updated.
Cool. Awesome. Yeah, I'll let you know for sure. It's definitely in the works, and I'm really excited about it. I think it'll be really cool.
Okay. Well, thank you so much, Tim, for coming on and talking to us. This was a really fun conversation. I don't think we really had an outline for this conversation, but it was pretty fun anyway.
Yeah. I had a really good time. Thank you.
So I'm going to go ahead and ask you our traditional penultimate question, which is, where would you like to be found on the internet?
I can be found on Instagram with Everyday Astronaut. It's all one word. Or Tim Dodd Photography. And Dodd is D-O-D-D. And those are my two main Instagram accounts. I also have Tim Dodd Photography on Facebook. And that's really about it. Yeah.
Cool. All right. And then our traditional final question is, if you had a trip into space, what's one object that you would want to bring with you?
So
don't say camera.
I would bring my crappy spacesuit because they would obviously provide a much, 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 much better alternative. But then I would just have this piece of crap falling apart Russian high altitude flight suit floating around in space. And I have these with the suit. I always have these little kids Fisher Price binoculars that I've been wearing for like the past 6 months with it. I just think that'd be hilarious. Like, you just see this guy that's just this idiot and like, yeah, with boots and stuff. I think that's what I'd take just for, because how stupid would that be?
That's very appropriate. I like that.
All right. Well, I guess that's it. So, yeah, thanks for coming on the show once again. And we will be sure to follow you on Instagram. I'm going to pay more attention to my Instagram account. And you are the one reason why.
Awesome.
All right, real quick, upcoming spaceflight events. We're just going to recap one that we already talked about last week because it's the only thing launching within the window of our 7 days of podcasting. But yeah, we had mentioned it last week. It was the H2A204, which is launching the Telstar 12 Vantage. Was it a communication satellite or a GPS? Okay, communication satellite. Yeah, so this was the one launching from Tanegashima, the beautiful launch complex that Ben loves so much. And launch window.
Well, that's November 24th.
Yep. Mentioned. Oh, sorry. Yeah. November 24th. The date's important, by the way, people. Yeah. So, I don't remember if the exact timer or anything has changed since last week.
I don't think so.
You don't think so? Yeah. I think it's still just the same as it was, which is, yeah, November 24th, universal time, 0623 hours. So at 6:23 in the morning, UTC time.
And then we have another one. This is Vega launching LISA Pathfinder on December 2nd. So that's right after our next show. So we want to make sure that you're aware of it. Its current T0 is, again, December 2nd, and this one's at 0415 UTC. LISA Pathfinder is a really cool mission. We'll probably talk about it more next show because we're trying to wrap up this show. And go check it out. It's going to, I believe, L2, Lagrange Point 2, and it's studying gravity waves, which is pretty awesome.
That is awesome. That's some hardcore science right there.
Those are your upcoming spaceflight events.
All right, so let's deal with the show then and cue the music, all of which, as always, is brought to you by Ronald Jenkins. Check him out at ronaldjenkins.com.
If you like this episode, please review us on iTunes and Stitcher.
And if you enjoyed our show, please consider supporting us on Patreon at patreon.com/orbitalpodcast.
You can connect with us on Twitter and Reddit at Orbital Podcast.
And you can send questions and comments to info@theorbitalmechanics.com.
For more information on this episode, such as show notes and other links, visit our website at theorbitalmechanics.com.
And that's it for episode number 34. So we will see you again in a week on orbit. Until then, later.
Goodbye.